Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's nearly impossible to resist an enthusiast. I mean someone who's enthusiastic about almost anything. For instance, Jolie Kerr. She's the columnist behind Ask a Clean Person. Now, she writes with surprising lust and delight about cleaning.
I love dish soap. I use dish soap for everything. I have fancy and utilitarian dish soap. My husband buys me fancy dish soap for, like, as my stocking stuffers at Christmas time.
How romantic.
And it is romantic, actually. For me, it really is, because I get the fancy stuff. I get the Mrs. Meyers.
That's Jolie Kerr, author of My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. A Clean Kitchen, New Greek Cooking, and more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Talk all the time about eating, cooking, drinking, but never the inevitable end to it all. The cleanup. Well, until now, with Jolie Kerr. When it comes to spiffing things up, she is definitely not a we'll clean up in the morning kind of girl. Her blog, Ask a Clean Person, appears both on Jezebel and Deadspin. In her new book, My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha, Jolie hits the basics, like how to use a mop, and the bizarre, like how to, well, remove that vomit from your Valentino. Rebecca Shear got a chance to talk cleaning with Jolie.
Hi there, Jolie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So your book starts with tackling the kitchen in terms of making it clean, and you give a very particular method for deep cleaning. In fact, you break it into three subsets.
Yes. The three subsets that I have for deep cleaning are what I call the hard clean, which is sort of your standard, you know, more than just wiping down a counter. Basically, the idea behind that is to take everything off of your counters. Clean the counters, clean your appliances, wipe anything down that lives on your countertops, and then put everything back. Then there's what I call the full Monty hard clean, which is the deeper thing where you're really going to get into more than just surface cleaning the appliances.
So like going inside your toaster oven, for instance?
Exactly. And then there's I separate out the pantry clean. You really have to think about what you're keeping and not keeping. So you have to do a purge. Then the last part of the pantry clean is that you have to sort of figure out where everything is going to go back. And if you need new storage solutions, you know, if a certain way of organizing things isn't working for you. I break it into kind of sort of levels of cleaning. And then I don't use that much stuff by way of products, actually. And that's actually sort of true of everything about cleaning. I really try, for my own life and when I talk to my readers, try to encourage people to use fewer products. You don't really need all that much, and it makes cleaning a lot faster if you're not switching products or reaching for a new thing or having to dive under the sink to find that, you know, bottle way, way in the back. So two things that I really love. One, I use Windex. I have one of those enamel stovetops, you know, the old gas, not very nice thing. I use Windex on it. I think Windex is great. I love sponges, those scrubby back sponges and Windex are like great. Love, love, love. I also love ammonia. And I'm gonna just say that I know that ammonia is not the most popular cleaning product for most people because it is a pretty harsh chemical. It's not environmentally safe. You have to wear gloves and you should
open
the
window. There's the odor as well.
Yeah, there's odor. I actually love the odor of it.
You like the odor
of
ammonia?
But I also am one of those. Yeah, but I also like the smell of, like, gasoline. You know, I'm like one of those people.
Aha, okay.
But I love ammonia in the kitchen, and the reason I really love it in the kitchen, first of all, you only have to use a really, really tiny amount. like a quarter cup at most, you know, obviously diluted in water. But it's great in the kitchen because it's a great degreaser. And the thing is, even when you don't have like a greasy spill, you know how your cabinets are always kind of have that sticky film?
Oh, yeah.
I hear a lot about sticky film from people. Basically what that is like a combination of grease that's just sort of like gone into the air and landed on your cabinets and then dust sticks to it. And ammonia is awesome for getting that off. Great for vent hoods. Those are also get really greasy and sticky. And then also dish soap. I love dish soap. I use dish soap for everything. I have fancy and utilitarian dish soap. My husband buys me fancy dish soap for like as my stocking stuffers at Christmas time.
How romantic.
And it is romantic, actually. For me, it really is because I get the fancy stuff. I get the Mrs. Meyers.
All right. So you mentioned dish soap, ammonia, Windex. But you have this great chart in your book called Using Foodstuffs to Solve Your Cleaning Conundrums.
Fun?
Wow, that stuff was surprising. I mean, using sliced bread to pick up shards of glass, really?
I love that one. Yeah. And the same thing with a sliced potato.
Oh.
That will also pick up the glass shards. And the idea is similar. They're kind of like porous. They're like the lint rollers of the food world.
And then
right?
in terms of eliminating odors, vodka.
I know. I mean, I think it's kind of a waste of good vodka, but... It's the same thing with people really like the one about using white wine to get out red wine stains.
Right.
Which, you know, it works, but I feel like, horrible waste of good white wine. I mean, I'd rather drink it than use it as a stain remover. I'd much rather save the club soda for the red wine stains.
So you mentioned that you're big on sponges, but don't sponges get really dirty or full of just stuff? I mean, aren't they kind of gross?
Yeah, they are gross. And yeah, they do get full of stuff. The stuff is a technical term. There are a couple ways that you can deal with sponges. The first is, you know, replacing them fairly frequently. I don't have a dishwasher, so I wash everything by hand, which means that they get torn up when I'm washing our knives and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you can replace them. They're not too expensive. But of course, that's a little bit wasteful. So you can sterilize sponges in a couple of different ways. The first way is to get them wet. Like fairly wet, you know, squeeze them out so they're not super dripping, but fairly wet, and microwave them for 2 minutes. That's going to kill 99% of the bacteria that's lurking in that sponge.
Wow.
I know. It's cool. The other thing you can do is you can put them, if you are lucky enough to have a dishwasher, you can put them in the dishwasher, top rack.
Huh. Running it with the dishwashing detergent in. Or
sure, you want to run them with dishes. Because the thing is, I mean, the detergent, it's not necessarily that you need the detergent to get them clean. It's really the heat of the dishwasher, the steam, that's going to do the sterilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jolie Kerr, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jolie Kerr is author of My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. Rebecca Shear is host of Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Take two people with an insatiable curiosity about food, the restaurant chef and the writer-designer who knows how to handle a camera. Add an agenda that's taken them around the globe, 12 countries in 18 months, and you have the award-winning PerennialPlate.com. Its creator, Chef Daniel Klein, and videographer Mira Fine are back from yet another remote location. Mira, Daniel, it's good to have you both back.
So good to be back.
Good to be back.
You've been in Ethiopia. What did you find there?
Well, first off, I mean, this is the last of a series of trips that we've been on, 12 countries in 14 months. And we thought having a show that's about food and the wonders of food, but also finishing with a country that's had so many challenges with it,
right,
is kind of a interesting way to end and kind of put things in perspective a little bit.
All that being said, we also love Ethiopian food, specifically injera. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a bread that they eat 3 times a day for all of their meals. It's super sour, it's spongy, and it's made on this big iron hot plate. So the bottom is really smooth and the top is very porous. And so Ethiopians will put dollops of stews on top, and the porous part of it will soak up the stews.
It's used almost like a plate.
It's used like a plate and a utensil, and you also eat it.
Yeah.
And injera is made with a type of cereal that grows in Ethiopia called teff.
So we ended up going to these different teff farmers' homes. these are extremely poor people, but so generous. You come in and first they prepare you coffee and do this beautiful ceremony for you. And then before filming anything, they want you to eat. And so they make this meal for you. And it's kind of hard because...
No one tells you that this is going to happen.
They're making fire with the dung, the cow dung. And then right after that, it's customary to feed your guest with your hands.
Uh-huh.
So this lovely woman who's just been playing around with cow dung then puts her fingers in your mouth. And you kind of feel like...
You can't be rude.
You can't be rude. Oh, you do it. You do it. Yeah, you can't say no. And it's delicious, but you are a little worried, or at least I was.
But, you know, also I think that idea that you share food even when you have almost nothing.
Yeah.
It's pretty dramatic.
It is.
It's a wonderful and sad truth of the world that people who have nothing are willing to give you...
Whatever they have.
Whatever they have. Mm-hmm. And that's never been more clear than in these homes in Ethiopia.
Now, teff is a grain that's the size of a grain of sand.
Yeah, it is. It's like amaranth, but way smaller.
Yeah. You know,
it's a grass, and they grow it in the fields and cut it. And then they put it in a big pile, and then they take their cows, and they walk over it over and over again. And so the cows are knocking the grain off of it.
Ah.
And then thresh it. You throw it in the air.
Oh, yes. And the
seeds come down.
The seeds come down because they're heavier, and the whatever chaff or whatever blows away.
But they're so tiny. And so the amount of work that goes into it is just... extraordinary. And I mean, a really interesting thing about growing teff there and talking to these farmers is that there seemed to be a big fear of a repeat of famine.
And
so,
of course.
Yeah. So we're oftentimes looking for people who have an individual point of view, a passion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really hard to find in Ethiopia because A, there's not the level of education. B, these farmers have never been asked, why do you farm? How do you feel about farming? That's just not something that is thought of. It's, I'm a farmer. That's what I do. That's what I've always done. And then because of this fear of famine, they are really doing what the government tells them to do. So we were hoping to find organic teff, and people who helped us organize it told us we were going to find organic teff. But then we walk into the home and we see the pesticide sprayer.
Uh-huh.
It's because it's what they think is going to be the right answer for avoiding famine.
Yeah, you'd imagine. You face famine and you've lost crops. You'd use every tool you could lay your hands on.
Of course.
Yeah, which is interesting because they also still use very traditional methods of harvesting, but they use non-traditional methods of spraying, and seeds they use are given to them by the government now. Sold to them by the government, yeah.
So they can't harvest those and just replant them the way farmers traditionally have done?
I think they are encouraged to use the improved seeds that the government is selling them.
But they have to buy those seeds.
It was interesting. This one farmer was doing quite well, but his only debt was actually to the government for the seeds and the pesticides. So we saw some interesting, complicated things happening in which they were placing their faith in this new system. And the old system perhaps had failed them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understandable, completely understandable.
What you found was the reality of the country.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, this was your last trip. So 12 countries, 14 months. How do you feel about what you've experienced?
After traveling to all these countries, I think we felt pretty inspired because here, when we were about to leave, everyone has their fears that they want to put on you about sickness, robbery, all these things.
Right.
And you visit 12 countries, you spend all these months going into people's homes, and, you know, we never got robbed. We got sick one time from a tourist restaurant.
Not from eating in anyone's home.
I got fleas in Ethiopia.
She got fleas.
It was my own fault.
We never experienced anti-Americanism. We had this wonderful experience in which we were able to connect with all these people. You know, we're just going to someone else's home. And to experience that was just a once-in-a-lifetime and inspiring experience.
It's great to see outside of the bubble that you live in. You know, I hadn't traveled very much at all before I started on this huge 12-country adventure. And it makes you appreciate what you have and see people differently as, like, you know, interesting and unique and equal. And it's just a wonderful experience that I would hope that lots of people would get to do.
Thank you both for sharing this with us.
It's been our
pleasure.
Thank
you so much. It's been so much fun.
Mira Fine and Daniel Klein are the perennialplate.com. Now, Be sure to head to the website to take a look at their work. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, modern Greek food and buffalo milk mozzarella. The challenge continues. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What does it mean when one redefines a cuisine as old as the cuisine of Greece? And really, would one dare? Chef Maria Ilia spent a summer cooking and experimenting at her father's tavern in the mountains of Cyprus. He's a Greek Cypriot. The collection that was born of that summer is a thoroughly modern take on the traditional flavors of Greece. Dishes like zucchini-coated calamari, carrot keftedes, honey-fried feta. She named her book Smashing Plates. Our contributor, Dori Greenspan, asked her why.
Well, every Sunday as a child, my dad would drag me to a Greek wedding. And the only part of the Greek wedding that I loved was the tables of mezes, you know, filled with amazing food. Like you get stuffed finis and meatballs and that was great. And I was telling a friend about my book that I was writing about my Greek heritage and whatnot. And I was going, oh, about Sundays and they went to Greek weddings and the fun part was the food and also the smashing plates. And she said, you have to call it smashing plates. But then I was worried because in England we say when something's great, we call it smashing. And I was like, oh, no, that's really egotistical, you know, that I'm calling my book Smashing Plates. But
but it's a great double meaning. But so were the plates truly smashed?
Yeah. At Greek weddings, you smash plates. It's like, you know, the new beginning. Like Jewish weddings, they stamp on glasses.
That's right. Well, it was so interesting to me as I read your wonderful introduction how you reconnected with your father and his homeland. I would love to hear the story of how you came to write this book.
So growing up with my dad, he's a chef, so I grew up in his restaurant just outside of London, and then the Sundays of the Greek weddings. And if it wasn't a wedding, we went to his sister-in-law's house, and she'd cook this huge array of food. And then my parents got divorced. And so suddenly I lost connection with the Greek side of my family. You know, and when you lose connection with the family, it's not just the relatives, and it sounds bad, but it was also the food, you know. And to me as a kid, I knew I wanted to be a chef since I was four. So the food was a major part of my life. So I think that was probably one of the major things I was upset about. I didn't eat Greek food anymore. So my dad moved away and then eventually back to Cyprus. And throughout my training, it was classical French. And then I worked abroad and looked at Asian cuisine. And then I worked in a restaurant which was British cuisine. So I couldn't really play with Greek ingredients. And then I changed jobs, which kind of was Mediterranean. And I was like, oh, well, I'm going to contact some suppliers that I hadn't used for years. And one was a Greek supplier. And I remember eating some feta and some finlies. And I suddenly went a bit quiet. And everyone kind of thought, oh, what's wrong with Maria? And I was like, oh, my God. You know, food is really, really emotive. And suddenly it was like a flashback to all the years I'd been missing eating the Greek cuisine and the connection. When you eat with Greeks, you share, you know, and it's like everybody comes together. And so it was so nostalgic. And I was like, this is what I need to reconnect with. So that's what I did. I phoned my dad, who was living in Cyprus. He has a small taverna in the Troodos Mountains. And I said, I want to come and cook with you. And he said, what do you want to do that for? And I was like, oh, come on, Dad. So I went to Cyprus for a month and hung out with him in his taverna, and we cooked together and kind of embraced Greek life. I mean, I'd been to Cyprus twice in my life before, the first time when I was 9 years old, and that was, you know, a massive experience, and the second time when I was about 20, and then I went back last year, so it was really humbling.
Well, and going back as a chef, as a grown-up, looking for understanding food, it's a different kind of trip. You know, you mentioned that the taste of the feta brought back what you had grown up with and what you were missing. And I was fascinated in reading your book to learn just how important cheese is in Greek cuisine.
Yeah, well, to me, I mean, there are so many cheeses in Greece, but one in particular to me is halloumi, and that's a Cypriot cheese. Cypriot is when I refer to Cyprus. So Cyprus is a small island where my dad's from, just off the coast of Greece. And I had the good fortune of some of the villagers invited me to make some halloumi with them. So traditionally it's made with goat's milk, but most people make it with a mix of sheep and goat's milk now, and some even with cows. But, you know, it's like such a great cheese. And people always go, oh, it kind of makes your teeth squeak, but fresh halloumi doesn't really make your teeth squeak so much. It tastes incredible. And if you just grill it lightly, it's like, wow, cheese like you've never tasted before. When you warm it, it doesn't melt. It just kind of softens and it's kind of springy, but there's a kind of texture that's almost like a little bit meaty about it. It's got guts, but it's not strong in flavour. It's just really mild, and it loves other flavours being put with it. Like, you could squeeze some lemon over it, put some chilli with it, throw some capers with it, you know, or fresh herbs. And then, of course, there's feta, and that's not a Cypriot cheese, that's a Greek cheese. And again, that's made with a mix of sheep's and goat's milk. And that's a wonderful cheese. I mean, most people just associate it with Greek salad, don't they? But if you were to bake Greek cheese and a little bit of olive oil and some chili flakes, it's amazing. Totally changes the texture. Doesn't melt, but just softens it, like pecorino, you know, when you have warm pecorino. And then my other favourite cheese, I mean, there are so many, but one that I love to use is Kefalotyri, which is a sheep's milk cheese, predominantly, and that's more like a pecorino parmesan, and you can shave that or grate that, and it's kind of salty and a little bit sour.
Well, it was interesting to me that cheese finds a place in every part of the meal, from starter to dessert.
Yeah.
And it's similar with honey in Greek cookery also, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, honey is a fantastic ingredient. I mean, you can use a little bit in a stufado, like a red wine stew, to sweeten it, or just honey poured over, you know, warmed feta. Two simple ingredients that just give so much, you know. And you think about the lands of, you know, Greece and its islands and Cyprus. It's so rich in its flora that if you were a bee, I mean, that's where you'd want to live. You know, you'd want to hang out with the orange blossoms and the chestnut flowers and the pine trees. There's a wealth of feeding, you know, and it's all so different. That's why honeys from all around Greece, you know, vary so much, and it's about which one you pick to put on what ingredient.
That's lovely. If I were a bee, yes, I would like to hang out
if
there.
If I was a bee, that's where I want to be, you know?
Well, you've done so much in the book to give us both traditional recipes and very modern takes on recipes and your own interpretations. Do you have one recipe that you think I should start with that would give us a real feel for what you've done, how you've redefined these Greek flavors?
I guess the best interpretation may be the carrot keftevis. So keftevis is a Greek meatball, and this is a vegetarian version. And I guess in essence it uses all the fresh herbs that you would associate with Greek cuisine, like the dill and the mint and the parsley, along with the cheeses. So I use Kefalotyri and feta. And so by using carrot, it kind of brings them all together. And carrot is a little bit sweet because I choose to roast it.
Well, I will be making it. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Maria Ilya is author of Smashing Plates, Greek Flavors Refined. Dori Greenspan is author of Baking Chez Moi. Now, Maria left us with a recipe for carrot keftedes. Now, this is pan-fried spiced carrot meatballs, minus the meat. Find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. It is time to play Stump the Cook, our culinary refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five ingredients that they actually have in their fridge. And I get to ask for a few staples like oil and water and seasonings and just three things that they really have on hand. And then I need to come up with something the caller would actually make in real life. Now, this week's player is Carl from Lincoln, Nebraska. So, Carl, welcome.
Oh, this sounds like it's going to be fun.
Okay. So, Carl, do you like to cook a lot?
Yeah, I do. When I get the opportunity, I work mostly nights, so I'm not at home with my family as much. But on the weekends, when I'm at home, I love to cook for them.
Well, that's great. So, I gather you have a diabolical list of ingredients ready to go, right?
Well, I don't know if I call it diabolical.
Well, okay. So, what are the ingredients?
Okay. They all have a thread for me that they're all things that my wife picks up at the grocery store that she thinks we can use, and we never get around to using. We have frozen tilapia fillets.
Frozen tilapia fillets, okay.
Rolled oats.
Rolled oats.
Baby carrots.
baby carrots.
Almond butter.
Right.
And minced garlic.
Oh. You know, as we used to say in French, this is a morceau du gâteau, or a piece of cake. Saying that, I am now, this is, by the way, Lynn scrambling. I talk my way through as the mind is saying, oh my God, okay, this should be easy, but what am I going to do with it? Okay, now, I get, for free, water, salt, pepper, one kind of fat, and three things that you have on hand. Okay.
Okay.
Do you have sriracha or any kind of sort of sweet hot sauce on hand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, we do have sriracha.
And egg?
Yes.
Lemon?
No.
No. Lime?
Unfortunately, no.
No. What kind of vinegar?
We do have like a regular vinegar. No flavor, just...
Just
plain old
regular.
Vinegar.
The plain old vinegar is never plain old. It's really wonderful. Okay, the first thing you're going to do is take the tilapia fillets, you know, defrost them in the fridge, rinse them,
right.
Pat them really dry, and then rub them with a little bit of the sriracha on all sides, okay?
Okay.
And put them back in the fridge on a plate, lightly cover them. And you only want them to be like that for about anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes. Before you do any of that, you can slice up the carrots. I like to make them into sticks. And throw them into the biggest, widest pan that you've got so that they're touching and they can be overlapping a bit. But, you know, you want them to have some space. Pour in a bit of olive oil. Have you got olive oil?
Yes.
Wonderful. Salt, black pepper, and a bit of water, and then about a tablespoon of the vinegar. And you cover the pan and you put it over low heat. And you'll check them every so often. Keep it low. You don't want them to burn, okay? When they're about halfway done, so they're still a bit crisp, you want to add that minced garlic, probably the equivalent of about 2 teaspoons. And then you continue cooking it, and you want to make sure those carrots get almost creamy. They may take 30 or 40 minutes. Okay, so they're now rolling along. Put aside the almond butter because that's going to finish them off. Now what you do is you take that tilapia, all right? You take a couple of eggs. You beat the eggs and you put them in a shallow bowl, you know, like a soup dish?
Right.
Or a pie plate. And then you're going to throw those rolled oats into a blender and just give them a whirl or two. You want to just break them up a little bit. And you're going to just pat the fish dry, okay? Don't rinse it because you want some of that snappiness of the sriracha. You're going to dip it in the egg and you're going to roll it in the oats.
Okay.
Some salt and pepper on that. And then you're going to take another skillet and you're going to film it with a bit of olive oil, put it over medium-high heat, and you're going to pan fry those fillets until they're golden brown on each side. You just want to get that fish really firm, but not to the point where it's falling apart. So figure, depending on the thickness, maybe a minute, 2 minutes per side. And then you take that off. You keep it warm. They'll finish cooking as you keep it warm. And when the carrots are tender, uncover them, cook off any excess liquid. That's going to glaze them. They're going to have a bit of a glow to them. And then take a couple of tablespoons of the almond butter. And just stir that in so you get this wonderful sweet nuttiness from the almond butter, the natural sweetness of the carrot, that little bit of vinegar. Spread the carrots on a platter and top it with the fish.
Okay.
So you have sort of a pan-roasted carrots with almond butter topped with this crunchy sriracha tilapia.
That sounds wonderful.
Do I pass?
I believe so. I think I might have to make that Friday.
Give it a shot and give us a call and let us know how it turns out, okay?
I will do that, yes.
You take care, Carl, and enjoy the food.
Well, thanks, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can find that recipe, sriracha oatmeal crusted tilapia, that I dreamed up for Carl at splendidtable.org. Now, if you want to challenge me to a round of Stump the Cook, head to the website, splendidtable.org. Mozzarella di bufala. Creamy, luscious. This is a cheese that is as close to fresh milk as you can get. And it's getting more and more popular in the States But did you know that all the buffalo mozzarella that we eat here is imported? By the time it gets to our table, it's about 2 weeks old. And that's pretty tragic for a cheese that's at its best when it's newly made, in the first 24 hours. Now, for years, cheesemakers in the United States have tried to produce real bufala, but they never quite have managed. One food writer called it the great white whale of American cheesemaking. It's elusive because that milk really does come from the buffalo, not the bison most Americans imagine when they hear buffalo, but the Asian water buffalo. And in its milk lies the key. Producer Shruthi Pinnanamy has the story.
When I was a kid, I used to see this ad on TV. Buffaloes grazing, village ladies pouring pearly white milk into copper pots. Taste of India. It's the Indian version of the Got Milk ads. India is home to most of the world's water buffalo. As a kid, I drank buffalo milk instead of cow milk. And let me tell you, it's disgusting. Oily and sickly sweet. As much as I hate the milk, though, I couldn't get enough of the stuff it was turned into. Ghee that smelled like warm sugar, or a cool pillowy curd eaten after a spicy meal. I moved to the U.S. decades ago, and I've been looking for that rich buffalo taste ever since.
The buffalo milk's the fourth milk, really, right?
Rob Kaufelt is the owner of Murray's Cheese in Manhattan, a popular store which now sells gourmet dairy products in several states.
Most of what we sell is cow, sheep, and goat. Every now and then somebody tries to sell camel milk or yak milk or human breast milk or whatever it is that's hot that week. But, of course, that never works. But buffalo milk is obviously the real thing. Nobody's been that successful in making it viable here yet.
I've come here to ask if there's some amazing buffalo milk product that's made in the U.S. It turns out there aren't, because there's just not enough buffalo milk to make them.
You know, water buffaloes are the divas of the dairy world.
Julia Collins, who also works at Murray's Cheese, knows all about these divas. She used to live on a buffalo dairy in Italy.
You know, they don't have sweat glands, so they laze around in the mud all day. If you want to take milk from a water buffalo, she has to be under the right conditions. She has to be nuzzled. When a water buffalo sees a stranger, she might stop giving her milk. That's how sensitive they are.
Also, buffaloes produce way less milk than cows. So they're more work, less profit. A handful of American dairies tried and fizzled out. How could anyone make a good business out of this?
These girls here are much older. You can tell that by their horns.
Steve Smith runs a buffalo dairy in Canyon City, Colorado. His girls are big and chocolatey black with thick, stubby horns.
What a rodeo when we first got started when we brought them in from the range.
Smith bought these buffaloes 5 years ago from a Texas ranch. It was hard work, he says, but now he's milking 100 of them and selling all the milk to a big cheese manufacturer.
Which they want more and more and more, which we want to get up to milking 400.
It's the largest buffalo dairy in the country, and the only one that's doing well. The secret to its success is guys like this.
Brady Shoup, B-R-A-D-Y-S-H-U-P-E.
You see, Shoup is an inmate of the Colorado prison system. The prison runs this dairy, which looks like any old dairy, except it's fenced in with razor wire. Inmates are paid less than regular workers, so Smith can afford to hire a whole lot of them. And he needs them because buffaloes are a lot of work.
Cows are much easier. They drop their milk real easy. These you have to actually milk them out by hand with the pumps.
But how could a regular dairy make it? One that doesn't have prison connections and isn't staffed full of hard workers like Shoup?
My name is Raffaele Mascolo from Caivano, Naples.
Like me, Mascolo grew up in a place with lots of buffalo.
Luisa, Maria, Angelina, Maria Bella, Pia. And believe it or not, when it's time, they call by name and they come to be milked.
Italy has plenty of buffalo milk. So Mascolo, who's a cheese consultant in the U.S., had this idea. Why not just skip the hassle of running a buffalo dairy in America? Why not just get the milk from Italy?
Wow. That's quite an operation.
It's a big operation. It's a very delicate milk, rich. It comes from the region of Campania.
The buffalo milk is evaporated in Italy, frozen, and then shipped to this cheese factory in Secaucus, New Jersey.
So what do we do here? We put water back, filter it, So we regenerate the milk, and this way becomes like a fresh milk.
This fresh milk is cultured in these giant metal tubs. The hunks of curd are then melted with jets of hot water and stretched. I see this sheet of marshmallow-like paste oozing out of the machine. Fresh buffalo mozzarella. It's cooled and shaped into little balls and embalmed in brine.
This is ready to eat.
Moscolo says his cheese will be fresher and cheaper than the fancy imported stuff. It's a multi-million dollar project. His master plan?
Go after all United States.
If it works, it would be the first American-made buffalo product to go mainstream. It could open the door to other products. Of course, we sat down to taste this fresh mozzarella.
Very similar to the product that I remember growing up, because the milk is the same.
I'm Indian, so I didn't grow up eating mozzarella di bufala. But what I really love here is watching Mascolo close his eyes and savor that memory in his mouth of being a boy and eating hunks of silky white bufala. You know, I may not find the buffalo yogurt or buffalo butter of my dreams here, but maybe I can just make do with finding people who share my dreams of buffalo.
Follow, 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 follow the buffalo.
Shruti Pinnanamy is an independent producer in New York City. Now we'll be back in a moment with your questions and a look at the wines from Mount Etna. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's time for us to connect. You can get to us, 800-537-5252. We're on Facebook and Twitter, and you can get to us by email. Go to splendidtable.org. Joel's calling from Dunn, North Carolina. Joel, what do you want to talk about?
Fermenting vegetables. So I am in the process of fermenting sauerkraut following Sandra Katz's method.
Oh, yes, yeah. The man who wrote The Art of Fermentation.
That's right.
Yes.
And there's a lot of talk about fermenting vegetables, but I want to know what you do with them once you have them. Not a lot of recipes out there that I've found. So I know sauerkraut on a hot dog or a bratwurst, but you know, what else can you do with them?
Well, you know, sauerkraut is one of those things. First of all, along the lines of the hot dog and, you know, that kind of thing, but very grand. There's a classical dish that comes from the Alsace region of France. That's the northeastern region that sits up against the border with Germany. And it's called choucroute garnie. And the choucroute is the French word essentially for sauerkraut. And what you do is you can take all kinds of delicious meat, a lot of pork, and this is can be a party dish or it can be just, you know, a weeknight supper. But the idea is you pick some great sausage that you really like. You might have some smoked meat. So you might have some smoked pork chops, a bit of smoked pork shoulder. You might do some roasted meat as well. And okay. And the idea is the variety of spicing in the sausage, in the smoked meat, in the fresh meat. You might want to cook them together in a bit of white wine and garlic, you know, slow roast them in the oven covered. They'd be absolutely fabulous. And then what you do is you take your sauerkraut that you've already made, a lot of it, you rinse it, and then you take the drippings from the pan in the oven, put them in a skillet, brown some onion, okay, and if you want some garlic, throw some juniper berries in there and things like thyme and sage, and then throw the sauerkraut in. And then let that just sauté a bit, and then you add white wine to it. A generous amount, like a cup, cup and a half. And you cook that all the way down. You put all the meats in with the sauerkraut. And now you can serve it right away, or you can just leave it in the fridge overnight and then reheat it the next day.
And sounds great.
It is to be. I mean, this is a feast. You'd start out with a green, you know, a green salad, and then this is dinner. And boiled potatoes always on the side. That's one tradition. Tradition away. Now, you know, one of the famous ways of doing sauerkraut is sweet sour with chopped up apples. And again, I like to brown onion first because sauerkraut takes to that sort of caramelized taste that you get from a browned onion. So I would put, you could use olive oil, you could use lard, but the idea is big skillet and you brown a generous amount of onion and throw some sliced apple in there. And I like things like Granny Smith, something tart and snappy. And brown the apple as well. Then add the sauerkraut. Then add a bit of sugar and then add some dry red wine or a bit of vinegar and then cook it for about 20 minutes or so. And what's going to happen is the acidity is going to cook out of the vinegar. The wine, most of the alcohol will cook off. And you'll do this to taste. You know, you may at the last minute want to add a little bit more of the vinegar or a little bit more of the sugar. But that browned onion is going to be one of the big keys, and then that apple. And that is a side dish with almost anything is really delicious, but especially grilled foods, you know, even grilled fish. It's just wonderful. So there's another thing. And then, of course, the other thing you can do is you can stuff fresh cabbage with sauerkraut cabbage.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, this is a more of a Northern European dish, but you take whole cabbage leaves, drop them in boiling water until they soften, just a few moments, pat them dry, and then you take your drained sauerkraut that you've browned, you know, you have a little browned onion and that kind of thing, and some sausage, and you wrap that up, and you put it in a pan, and you bake it with a tomato sauce.
Very good.
And it's really tasty. And it's, you know, but again, pretty hearty stuff.
Excellent. I'm going to be busy.
You're going to be very busy. And don't forget sauerkraut salad, oil, vinegar, sauerkraut, more vinegar than oil.
All right.
Okay.
Sounds great.
Start making more sauerkraut. You take care. Bye, Joel.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252 or splendidtable.org for an email or Facebook, Twitter. I want to bring back a golden oldie. In the days when everybody was first discovering that there was food on the other side of the Atlantic, there was a mustard, a coarse, delicious mustard that people called Dijon, but it wasn't from Dijon. And it became very popular. It came in this gorgeous stone crock, and it was called Moutarde de Meaux, M-E-A-U-X. By the way, this is the same part of France that the famous Brie comes from. Well, it fell out of favor. And recently, I saw it on Amazon, and I could not resist. Now, granted, it's expensive. But this is one of the great mustards of the world. It's mild. You can eat it with a spoon, but it has flavor. It's coarse ground. It's kind of loose. But it, I don't know, it makes all the honey mustard and the, you know, chipotle and whatever. They all look like Johnny Come Latelys. They all look like bad imitations. This is a beautiful mustard. It's a mustard that you stir into cream when you're cooking chicken. It's a mustard that you spread on really nice ham. It's a mustard that you toss green beans and potatoes with and a little olive oil. This is a mustard for the ages. So it's Moutarde de Meaux. Brace yourself. It's expensive, but a little goes a long way. And by the way, one thing to remember about mustard is, I learned this from a mustard maker in Belgium. If you keep it cold, it will stay hot. So you always chill mustard. 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Sandra's on the line from Boyds, Maryland. Sandra, what's on your mind?
Smoking.
Excuse me?
My husband and I just bought a smoker.
Uh-huh.
And it's one attached to the charcoal grill. And he's the king of smoking, so I can't say I've used it yet. In fact, he's only used it once, and it came out wonderful. We had ribs. They were wonderful. But I need some other ideas. My mother's coming to visit, and she wants something smoked on the grill.
Oh, golly, you could do chicken or turkey breast. You could do fish. You could do almost anything. I mean, the real key to this is just watch that it doesn't get overcooked. But
yeah.
I would say, you know, I mean, okay, so if you've done ribs.
We have, but we can't do fish. It'll kill my husband.
Oh, dear. Okay, no, we won't do fish then. But I'm thinking of something really simple. I've got it. Do you folks like hot food? You know, spicy?
Mm-hmm.
You do? There's a recipe I've sort of played with that came from Padma Lakshmi. She's the host of the Top Chef series. Uh-huh. And this is done with chipotle chilies and adobo. You know, they come in a little can and they're in a tomato sauce. They're as hot as you know what. And then dried dates, right? And hoisin sauce and vinegar and a bit of soy. And you pureed in the food processor. Oh, I forgot to tell you, I had about 10 cloves of garlic.
Only 10,
but that's, I make about 3 cups of this stuff. And, you know, about a cup of it gets smushed on the chicken overnight. And then the rest of it is, you know, toward the end of cooking, you want to be brushing that on. And it'll form a sticky, delicious, incredible, hot, sweet, spicy, wonderful glaze.
Oh, I've been writing madly as you talk. This is wonderful.
Now, start out with just one of those chilies in its sauce because it's hot, and then you can always fool around. But start out with a little bit of each thing and then just keep building it up.
Well, that's all very exciting.
Oh, it's going to be great fun. You're going to have a wonderful time. Yeah. And enjoy the new toy.
Okay. Well, we are. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Sandra. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can get to us, 800-537-5252. So what is it with the snobbery of wine vintage charts? Their Italian sections often show only Tuscany and the Piedmont. Now talk about insulting an entire country. Wines that you would love trying come from every single one of Italy's 20-some regions. For instance, Sicily. Like a lot of Italy, the island is in the midst of a winemaking renaissance. New wines, well, at least for us, are coming from ancient sources. One New York chef, Melissa Daca, has the heritage and the passion to know a great deal about these wines. Melissa, good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So the wines of Mount Etna, what are they about?
Well, there's a very large mountain, volcano, and there's several vineyards on that volcano, from low altitudes to high altitudes. And the wines change very much depending on where they're located, at what altitude and at what exposure to the sun and to the sea. But they're very intense wines. They're intense just like the fireworks of the lava that spits out of the volcano. They have deep mineral flavors to them. They have notes of berries, of spiciness, and they're very food-friendly.
So what kinds of wines are we talking about? I mean, are they mainly reds? Are they mainly whites?
There's both. There's the Etno Rosso. The winemaking laws have them with 80% Nerello Mascalese grape. There's also the whites made mainly with Caricante grape. And then there's sparkling wines made with those grapes. There's rosés. And there's some what I call super Etno Rossos, which would be anything that's not grown with those grapes on the mountain, which do not get a DOC designation, but that are some fabulous wines as well.
So what is the taste of this red grape?
The taste is a deep, rich, very mineral-rich wine that has a smokiness to it, almost it's growing on volcanic soil and volcanic ashy soil. And the minerals that are in that soil come through in a surprising way. If you take the soil and actually smell it and then do the same with the wine, there's notes of the minerals that come through that you can smell on both of them, both on the soil and in the wine. Also, some of the wines have beautiful notes of violets and roses, while others have a deeper sense of dark berries or fresh crushed berries or plums. Mm. But all of them tend to have a smoky minerality to them that tends to be quite elegant. I've yet to taste a wine from Etna that I wouldn't characterize as just an elegant wine.
Let's talk about the white. Now, there's the one white grape. Could you say the name again?
Caricante. That's the main white grape that's going into the Etna Bianco. There are a few others that grow on the mountain, but the Etna Biancos are known for the Caricante. Just like many whites that are grown at high altitude, there's a lot of green apple on the nose. There's a tartness to them, and they have a very strong acidic backbone, so they actually age very well.
Uh-huh.
They also have notes of white flowers, of honey, and again, the strong mineral content. The soil comes through on the whites in a very pleasant way.
Interesting. So can you give us some names of wines to look for so we can try these?
Of course. As for a white, I would suggest Planeta's Caricante. For reds, I would look for Benanti's Rosso di Vercella or Girolamo Russo's wines. Morgo has an entry-level Etna Rosso that you can find for about $12. But there are so many producers, and it's very hard to limit them down to a few. Price range, you could find anywhere from the $12 all the way up to about the $90 to $100 range. But the $20 to $30 range has some excellent wines.
This is great to know, and we'll put up that information on the website. Melissa, thanks so much for this.
Thank you, Lynn. It was a pleasure.
Melissa Daca is chef owner of New York's Bar Iolo, and you can find her Mount Etna wine suggestions on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from the Greek poet Homer. He wrote, "No poem was ever written by a drinker of water." Dinner Party Download is a fast and funny hour serving up culture, food, interviews, drink recipes, and other elements for a winning dinner party. Find Dinner Party Download on your podcast app. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Visit splendidtable.org to catch up on everything you heard here today. Register for our giveaways and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and download podcasts of The Splendid Table. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.